right, thank you, Sammy. This is another piece in the puzzle that we'll be considering today. And the basic question is, does immunity develop after a first infection that protects human beings from a repeat infection? So if I, at one point in my life, had had a chlamydial infection and it resolved, and I was exposed to an infected partner, if I did not get chlamydia, if my tests were negative after that exposure, we would consider that to be complete immunity, or the sterilizing immunity that Tony was speaking of. If, on the other hand, after this exposure, I developed an infection, but it only lasted a short period of time and only had a few chlamydia that were shed, this would be considered partial immunity, and I'll show you some pictures of this in just a moment. I want you to be clear that we're talking about infection, protection against infection here, not protection against pathology or exacerbation of pathology. And because there is an ethical and medical necessity to treat chlamydial infections in human beings, as Will pointed out, there's very little good data about the natural history of infections once they occur. But there is plenty of data in animal models, and I will show you a couple of slides regarding rodent models, which have been the most widely used, and to give you a sense of what this is like. So in this study that was published by Morrison and Caldwell a number of years ago in mice, chlamydia-naive mice were infected at time zero with a standard single dose of chlamydia. Within 3 days, all of the animals were infected, as shown by the closed circles, and they had very high numbers of chlamydia. They were shedding millions of chlamydia. Within a week, all 10 were still infected, shedding hundreds of thousands of chlamydia. At day 14, or 2 weeks, all 10 still infected, but now the infection is beginning to lessen with tens of thousands of chlamydia. By 3 weeks in this model, two of the animals had already cleared. They were culture negative at 3 weeks. 8 of 10 were still infected. They were shedding hundreds of chlamydia. I just want you to reflect just a moment what this means. Millions, and 3 weeks later, just a few hundred. So this is an effective response. At 4 weeks, only one of 10 animals was still infected. And after 5 weeks, all the animals had recovered. Now, if you give these now experienced chlamydial infected mice who have resolved about a month's rest and give them the same dose of chlamydia that you gave them at the beginning of the study, 6 out of the 10 did not get infected again. That's complete immunity, as we might term it. 4 of the animals did get infected, but only had hundreds of organisms rather than millions. And within a couple of weeks, they had cleared. Now, this begs the question of, well, what happens if you delay the re-exposure? And in a different rodent model, presented in a slightly different way, this is what the answer is. Primary infection here, guinea pigs all get infected, duration about 3 weeks, similar to the mice, and the peak intensity is very high. If within 2 weeks you reinfect these guinea pigs, only 30% of them become infected again. So again, 70% have complete immunity, and 30% have a partial immunity where a very brief duration of infection at a very low intensity. But what I would like to point out, and this is the case in mice models as well, if 2 months passes, or 5 months pass, or 9 months pass, virtually every animal becomes reinfected on exposure to chlamydia. They are partially protected. The duration of infection is less, the intensity is lower. So these have been replicated in the rodent models multiple times, and this is what complete and partial immunity are. Well, you've heard some already, a lot actually, about what immune responses are responsible for this downregulation of chlamydial growth after infection. These lymphocytes of the T helper or CD4 type come to the infected mucosal sites in animal models. They elaborate this very powerful substance, gamma interferon, which restricts chlamydial growth. Interestingly, though, this is a temporary phenomenon. As the chlamydial numbers go down, the number of cells decrease, and this is probably what is responsible for the partial susceptibility that occurs relatively soon after the primary infection. The time course and decrease in these mucosal lymphocytes are correlated with a return of partial susceptibility. We also know that there are long-lasting chlamydia-specific antibodies that are present in serum that probably transudate into the lower genital tract, and that these may well reduce the number of chlamydia that are capable of establishing an infection initially, resulting in these low levels of chlamydia on repeat infection. And then because our immune systems, the animal's immune systems, have memory cells, they very rapidly come to the mucosal site and more rapidly clear the repeat infections. Now, let's move back to people. Are there studies that support the idea that these same immune mechanisms are operative in human beings? And there are a number of studies. They're hard to do and they have limitations. But we do know that there is a T cell infiltrate that occurs at the infected in the cervix, and that it tends to resolve with treatment. We know that these important substances like gamma interferon actually are present at the infected cervix, and that they too decrease after treatment of the infection. Chlamydia-specific antibodies are present at the end of cervix, and they tend to be long-lasting, and they are associated, in one study, with a reduced organism load. So there are a lot of indirect epidemiologic studies that support the notion of some degree of protective immunity in people. You can't do the time course studies in human beings. Give them an infection, watch and see what happens over time. Can't do it. We do know that a variety of studies have shown that chlamydia prevalence, the number of organisms in the genital secretions, and infection concordant rates in couples decrease with age. The notion here is that as populations grow older, they have more experience with chlamydia, they accrue some degree of immunity, and therefore these measures are lower. In one longitudinal study in sex workers in Africa, young age and being in the sex work industry for less than 2 years are associated with an increased risk of incident infection. But I have to say that in that study, as well as in every other study that I'm aware of, that a baseline chlamydial infection is one of the strongest predictors of an incident infection down the road. We also know from a couple of small studies that the organism load is lower in repeat infections. In high-risk women, and probably men as well, repeated infections are very common, largely the result of reinfection, and this suggests that the immunity that exists can only be partial at best. And in that regard would parallel what is seen in the animal studies that I showed you at the beginning. Another question that was asked is there a test, is there a study that can be done that will identify a given individual or group of individuals as having this partial protective immunity? And the one study that suggests that that may be the case was a longitudinal study. Most of what I've shown you in people so far is that they're cross-sectional or at most only a couple of data points. But in a longitudinal study of incident chlamydial infection in sex workers, what was found is that when the subjects or participants entered the study, if they produced gamma interferon, with their blood cells in response to chlamydial proteins, those people had a significantly lower risk of incident infection. Problem is that this is a study done in sex workers. There were 299 of them, and only 29 had this attribute at the beginning of the study. So although a very interesting and perhaps important lead, this needs to be followed up in other populations. Well, if immunity appears to be only partially protective, what good is it? I can think of a couple of things which I've tried to word here, but not very well. So let me take myself as one of these infected chlamydia people. So the first scenario is transmission. Let's say that I've had chlamydia, I recovered, I had a contact with an infected partner, and I acquired an infection. If I have partial immunity, my infection will be short and low intensity. And therefore, an argument could be made that those people might be less likely to transmit to other partners. It's not been proven in clinical studies, but this is a reasonable hypothesis. The second scenario here is acquisition, has to do with acquisition of infection. So I've had my infection, I have gotten better. I have been uninfected currently, but have been exposed to an infected partner. If I have these antibodies that may reduce the number of chlamydia that actually can establish an infection, I may be less likely to acquire infection, especially if my partner has a low intensity exposure or exposes me to a low number of organisms. So there would be a potential for decreased transmission, decreased acquisition. These things have yet to be proven. Partial immunity, as has already been discussed in some detail, could either promote or reduce the risk of upper tract disease. There's also been some discussion by the previous speaker that if we're so good that we find infections really early and treat them really quickly, that we may be reducing the duration of infection, may be impairing the development of this protective immunity. And in rodent models, where you can treat within a few days after inducing the infection, if you treat before the immune response has had a chance to fully develop, you can certainly abrogate part of the protective immune response. There's epidemiologic data from some programs, most notably in British Columbia, that would suggest that increased isolation rates may be due to an increased number of repeated infections. And then thinking, well, if immunity is not as good in this population because we're screening and treating and that sort of thing, that we may be impairing the population level of immunity. I think that although this data is consistent with that idea, there are probably other things that are happening. For example, changes in screening frequency, screening coverage, and other more epidemiologically related factors. So in summary, the limited human data that do exist suggests that some degree of protective immunity to infection develops in people. This protective immunity can only be partial at best and can be overcome on re-exposure. We do not know the duration of any protective immunity that develops, and the strength is uncertain. But there are good parallels with the immune mechanisms that we're seeing in animal models. So if we're going to learn more about whether protective immunity develops, what its correlates are, and whether it has an impact on transmission within populations, these are some of the ideas that would have to be incorporated in these studies. Cross-sectional studies aren't going to do it for us. Longitudinal approaches with repeated observations over time are absolutely necessary. With baseline and subsequent measures of candidate immune markers like this gamma interferon thing in blood, serial sampling for incident infection. I think we're going to have to determine organism load in the future. We haven't done that previously, and that's a part of the partial immunity as we understand it currently. Detailed behavioral information, DNA-based strain typing, scheduled periods of frequent non-invasive sampling in order to determine onset of incident infections and perhaps try to estimate their duration. And studies within sexual partnerships could also be very helpful. I believe I'll stop here, and if I can clarify anything, please ask.
Are there any other questions for Dr. Badiker?
One quick one. Is the partial immunity strain specific?
I'm sorry?
Is the partial immunity strain specific?
Interestingly, in the animal models, it is a single strain situation. In the human studies, there's really no compelling evidence that suggests that serotype or genotype specific immunity occurs. It may be partial, but certainly there's no complete immunity that can be determined.
Was there one other question? Or?
Yes. Hi.
Give you my opinion. We are in the clinic obtaining a diagnostic test on a one-time basis in a high-risk group. We don't know if it's the end of a very long infection, the beginning of an infection, whether that person is partially immune or whether they're not partially immune. It's not clear to us whether early or late treatment has any effect on upper tract disease. And I, like you, I believe, would treat them as promptly as possible.
Right, but I don't know if after my treatment that they are cured. I mean, I've got about 20%.
Oh, no, I think so treatment failures. There are a couple of ways of estimating treatment success. One are controlled clinical trials where you get efficacy data. And with azithromycin or doxycycline, either one, you're up in the very high 90% range, 97%. There are a couple of clinical studies that Will referred to, one that we were involved with at Indiana and another at the University of Washington, that suggested that the real world use effectiveness may be more like 92% or so. But these are estimates, and still that efficacy is quite good.
And Will has one more comment, and then I think maybe we can discuss some of these things at the very end, because we'll try and bring it all together in the next talk.
Just let me make a couple points. I mean, one thing is, you know, we don't do tests of cures in the non-pregnant population. The pregnant population is the highest risk, but we do actually repeat screening in approximately 3 months. So it's very possible that, you know, some of these people who have, quote, persisting rather than recurrent infections, that we will at least pick it up within a 3 month period. Hopefully that will limit some of the complications. The other thing is, let me clarify that when we were talking earlier about spontaneous resolution, and I was talking about basically resolution from the urethra, from the cervix. So we still, if a woman comes in, we're still gonna treat them no matter what. You know, even though we do, in these studies, we do repeat testing at the time of treatment, we're still treating them. And even if that test was negative, essentially we're still treating them now, because just because they've cleared it from the cervix or the urethra doesn't mean they don't have upper genital tract infection still. We don't know that in humans. So everybody gets treated kind of irrespective of this kind of repeat test follow-up.
Let me ask a question for you, Matt. So if the student comes in for a test of cure, is what they call it, but it's really not a test of cure anymore, it's just a repeat test, right?
At 3 months, it's a repeat test, right?
But they come in for the repeat test, and let's say that repeat test comes back positive again.
Right.
Now, we don't know whether it's a persistent infection or if they've been reinfected.
That's correct.
All right, but we treat them again with the same thing, the Zithromax again, or do we switch to doxycycline the second time, assuming that the Zithromax didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, at least based on published literature right now, there's no antimicrobial resistance issues with doxy or azithro. As far as we know, they're both equally efficacious based on at least older studies with culture data. So most likely people are failing treatment because they're reinfected.
Right.
Now, I have a study after the lecture we can talk about. I have an ongoing study, kind of a different study design, that's going to look at the true efficacy of azithro versus doxy, excluding this reinfection issue. And hopefully in about 3 years from now, we'll have some answers there. But for now, I think you treat with probably azithro because you know that they will take the one dose. The doxy compliance is going to be lower.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.